Disc 24.
Mrs. Bulstrode felt suddenly rather chill and trembling. There was evidently something unusual behind this speech of Mrs. Hackbutt's, but though she had set out with the desire to be fully informed, she found herself unable now to pursue her brave purpose, and turning the conversation by an inquiry about the young Hackbutts, she soon took her leave, saying that she was going to see Mrs. Plimdale. On her way thither, she tried to imagine that there might have been some unusually warm sparring at the meeting between Mr. Bulstrode and some of his frequent opponents. Perhaps Mr. Hackbutt might have been one of them. That would account for everything. But when she was in conversation with Mrs. Plimdale, that comforting explanation seemed no longer tenable. Selina received her with a pathetic affectionateness and a disposition to give edifying answers on the commonest topics, which could hardly have reference to an ordinary quarrel of which the most important consequence was a perturbation of Mr. Bulstrode's health. Beforehand, Mrs. Bulstrode had thought that she would sooner question Mrs. Plimdale than anyone else, but she found to her surprise that an old friend is not always the person whom it is easiest to make a confidant of. There was the barrier of remembered communication under other circumstances. There was the dislike of being pitied and informed by one who had been long wont to allow her the superiority. For certain words of mysterious appropriateness that Mrs. Plimdale let fall about her resolution never to turn her back on her friends convinced Mrs. Bulstrode that what had happened must be some kind of misfortune, and instead of being able to say with her native directness, "What is it that you have in your mind?" she found herself anxious to get away before she had heard anything more explicit. She began to have an agitating certainty that the misfortune was something more than the mere loss of money, being keenly sensitive to the fact that Selina now, just as Mrs. Hackbutt had done before, avoided noticing what she said about her husband as they would have avoided noticing a personal blemish. She said goodbye with nervous haste and told the coachman to drive to Mr. Vincey's warehouse. In that short drive, her dread gathered so much force from the sense of darkness that when she entered the private counting-house where her brother sat at his desk, her knees trembled, and her usually florid face was deathly pale. Something of the same effect was produced in him by the sight of her. He rose from his seat to meet her, took her by the hand, and said with his impulsive rashness, "God help you, Harriet. You know all." That moment was perhaps worse than any which came after. It contained that concentrated experience which in great crises of emotion reveals the bias of a nature, and is prophetic of the ultimate act which will end an intermediate struggle. Without that memory of Raffles, she might still have thought only of monetary ruin. But now, along with her brother's look and words, there darted into her mind the idea of some guilt in her husband. Then, under the working of terror, came the image of her husband exposed to disgrace, and then, after an instant of scorching shame in which she felt only the eyes of the world, with one leap of her heart she was at his side in mournful but unreproaching fellowship with shame and isolation. All this went on within her in a mere flash of time, while she sank into the chair and raised her eyes to her brother, who stood over her.
"I know nothing, Walter. What is it?"
she said faintly. He told her everything, very inartificially, in slow fragments, making her aware that the scandal went much beyond proof, especially as to the end of Raffles.
"People will talk," he said. "Even if a man has been acquitted by a jury, they'll talk and nod and wink. And as far as the world goes, a man might often as well be guilty as not. It's a breakdown blow, and it damages Lydgate as much as Bulstrode. I don't pretend to say what is the truth. I only wish we had never heard the name of either Bulstrode or Lydgate. You'd better have been a Vincey all your life, and so had Rosamond."
Mrs. Bulstrode made no reply.
"But you must bear up as well as you can, Harriet. People don't blame you, and I'll stand by you whatever you make up your mind to do," said the brother, with rough but well-meaning affectionateness.
"Give me your arm to the carriage, Walter," said Mrs. Bulstrode. "I feel very weak."
and when she got home, she was obliged to say to her daughter, "I am not well, my dear. I must go and lie down. Attend to your papa. Leave me in quiet. I shall take no dinner." She locked herself in her room. She needed time to get used to her maimed consciousness, her poor, lopped life, before she could walk steadily to the place allotted her. A new searching light had fallen on her husband's character, and she could not judge him leniently. The 20 years in which she had believed in him and venerated him by virtue of his concealments came back with particulars that made them seem an odious deceit. He had married her with that bad past life hidden behind him, and she had no faith left to protest his innocence of the worst that was imputed to him. Her honest, ostentatious nature made the sharing of a merited dishonour as bitter as it could be to any mortal. But this imperfectly taught woman, whose phrases and habits were an odd patchwork, had a loyal spirit within her. The man whose prosperity she had shared through nearly half a life, and who had unvaryingly cherished her, now that punishment had befallen him, it was not possible to her in any sense to forsake him. There is a forsaking which still sits at the same board and lies on the same couch with the forsaken soul, withering it the more by unloving proximity. She knew, when she locked her door, that she should unlock it, ready to go down to her unhappy husband and espouse his sorrow and say of his guilt, "I will mourn and not reproach." But she needed time to gather up her strength. She needed to sob out her farewell to all the gladness and pride of her life. When she had resolved to go down, she prepared herself by some little acts, which might seem mere folly to a hard onlooker. They were her way of expressing to all spectators, visible or invisible, that she had begun a new life in which she embraced humiliation. She took off all her ornaments and put on a plain black gown, and instead of wearing her much-adorned cap and large bows of hair, she brushed her hair down and put on a plain bonnet cap, which made her look suddenly like an early Methodist. Bulstrode, who knew that his wife had been out and had come in saying she was not well, had spent the time in an agitation equal to hers. He had looked forward to her learning the truth from others, and had acquiesced in that probability as something easier to him than any confession. But now that he imagined the moment of her knowledge come, he awaited the result in anguish. His daughters had been obliged to consent to leave him, and though he had allowed some food to be brought to him, he had not touched it. He felt himself perishing slowly in unpitied misery. Perhaps he should never see his wife's face with affection in it again, and if he turned to God, there seemed to be no answer but the pressure of retribution. It was 8 o'clock in the evening before the door opened and his wife entered. He dared not look up at her. He sat with his eyes bent down, and as she went towards him, she thought he looked smaller. He seemed so withered and shrunken. A movement of new compassion and old tenderness went through her like a great wave, and putting one hand on his which rested on the arm of the chair, and the other on his shoulder, she said, solemnly but kindly, "Look up, Nicholas." He raised his eyes with a little start, and looked at her, half amazed for a moment. Her pale face, her changed mourning dress, the trembling about her mouth, all said, "I know," and her hands and eyes rested gently on him. He burst out crying, and they cried together, she sitting at his side. They could not yet speak to each other of the shame which she was bearing with him, or of the acts which had brought it down on them. His confession was silent, and her promise of faithfulness was silent. Open-minded as she was, she nevertheless shrank from the words which would have expressed their mutual consciousness, as she would have shrunk from flakes of fire. She could not say, "How much is only slander and false suspicion?" And he did not say, "I am innocent." Chapter 75. Rosamond had a gleam of returning cheerfulness when the house was freed from the threatening figure, and when all the disagreeable creditors were paid. But she was not joyous. Her married life had fulfilled none of her hopes, and had been quite spoiled for her imagination. In this brief interval of calm, Lydgate, remembering that he had often been stormy in his hours of perturbation, and mindful of the pain Rosamond had had to bear, was carefully gentle towards her. But he too had lost some of his old spirit, and he still felt it necessary to refer to an economical change in their way of living as a matter of course, trying to reconcile her to it gradually, and repressing his anger when she answered by wishing that he would go to live in London. When she did not make this answer, she listened languidly, and wondered what she had that was worth living for. The hard and contemptuous words which had fallen from her husband in his anger had deeply offended that vanity which he had at first called into active enjoyment. And what she regarded as his perverse way of looking at things kept up a secret repulsion which made her receive all his tenderness as a poor substitute for the happiness he had failed to give her. They were at a disadvantage with their neighbours, and there was no longer any outlook towards Quallingham. There was no outlook anywhere, except in an occasional letter from Will Ladislaw. She had felt stung and disappointed by Will's resolution to quit Middlemarch, for in spite of what she knew and guessed about his admiration for Dorothea, she secretly cherished the belief that he had, or would necessarily come to have, much more admiration for herself, Rosamond being one of those women who live much in the idea that each man they meet would have preferred them if the preference had not been hopeless. Mrs. Casaubon was all very well, but Will's interest in her dated before he knew Mrs. Lydgate. Rosamond took his way of talking to herself, which was a mixture of playful fault-finding and hyperbolical gallantry, as the disguise of a deeper feeling, and in his presence she felt that agreeable titillation of vanity and sense of romantic drama which Lydgate's presence had no longer the magic to create. She even fancied, what will not men and women fancy in these matters, that Will exaggerated his admiration for Mrs. Casaubon in order to pique herself. In this way, poor Rosamond's brain had been busy before Will's departure. He would have made, she thought, a much more suitable husband for her than she had found in Lydgate. No notion could have been falser than this, for Rosamond's discontent in her marriage was due to the conditions of marriage itself, to its demand for self-suppression and tolerance, and not to the nature of her husband. But the easy conception of an unreal better had a sentimental charm which diverted her ennui. She constructed a little romance which was to vary the flatness of her life. Will Ladislaw was always to be a bachelor and live near her, always to be at her command, and have an understood, though never fully expressed, passion for her, which would be sending out lambent flames every now and then in interesting scenes. His departure had been a proportionate disappointment, and had sadly increased her weariness of Middlemarch. But at first she had the alternative dream of pleasure in store from her intercourse with the family at Quallingham. Since then, the troubles of her married life had deepened, and the absence of other relief encouraged her regretful rumination over that thin romance which she had once fed on. Men and women make sad mistakes about their own symptoms, taking their vague, uneasy longings, sometimes for genius, sometimes for religion, and oftener still for a mighty love. Will Ladislaw had written chatty letters, half to her and half to Lydgate, and she had replied. Their separation, she felt, was not likely to be final, and the change she now most longed for was that Lydgate should go to live in London. Everything would be agreeable in London, and she had set to work with quiet determination to win this result, when there came a sudden, delightful promise which inspirited her. It came shortly before the memorable meeting at the town hall, and was nothing less than a letter from Will Ladislaw to Lydgate, which turned chiefly on his new interest in plans of colonization, but mentioned, incidentally, that he might find it necessary to pay a visit to Middlemarch within the next few weeks. A very pleasant necessity, he said, almost as good as holidays to a schoolboy. He hoped there was his old place on the rug and a great deal of music in store for him, but he was quite uncertain as to the time. While Lydgate was reading the letter to Rosamond, her face looked like a reviving flower. It grew prettier and more blooming. There was nothing unendurable now. The debts were paid, Mr. Ladislaw was coming, and Lydgate would be persuaded to leave Middlemarch and settle in London, which was so different from a provincial town. That was a bright bit of morning. But soon the sky became black over poor Rosamond. The presence of a new gloom in her husband, about which he was entirely reserved towards her, for he dreaded to expose his lacerated feeling to her neutrality and misconception, soon received a painfully strange explanation, alien to all her previous notions of what could affect her happiness. In the new gaiety of her spirits, thinking that Lydgate had merely a worse fit of moodiness than usual, causing him to leave her remarks unanswered, and evidently to keep out of her way as much as possible, she chose, a few days after the meeting, and without speaking to him on the subject, to send out notes of invitation for a small evening party, feeling convinced that this was a judicious step, since people seemed to have been keeping aloof from them and wanted restoring to the old habit of intercourse. When the invitations had been accepted, she would tell Lydgate, and give him a wise admonition as to how a medical man should behave to his neighbours, for Rosamond had the gravest little airs possible about other people's duties. But all the invitations were declined, and the last answer came into Lydgate's hands.
"This is Chicheley's scratch. What is he writing to you about?" said Lydgate, wonderingly, as he handed the note to her.
She was obliged to let him see it, and looking at her severely, he said,
"Why on earth have you been sending out invitations without telling me, Rosamond? I beg, I insist that you will not invite anyone to this house. I suppose you have been inviting others, and they have refused too."
She said nothing.
"Do you hear me?" thundered Lydgate.
"Yes, certainly I hear you," said Rosamond,
turning her head aside with the movement of a graceful, long-necked bird. Lydgate tossed his head without any grace and walked out of the room, feeling himself dangerous. Rosamond's thought was that he was getting more and more unbearable, not that there was any new special reason for this peremptoriness. His indisposition to tell her anything in which he was sure beforehand that she would not be interested was growing into an unreflecting habit, and she was in ignorance of everything connected with the £1,000, except that the loan had come from her uncle Bulstrode. Lydgate's odious humours, and their neighbours' apparent avoidance of them, had an unaccountable date for her in their relief from money difficulties. If the invitations had been accepted, she would have gone to invite her mamma and the rest, whom she had seen nothing of for several days, and she now put on her bonnet to go and inquire what had become of them all, suddenly feeling as if there were a conspiracy to leave her in isolation with a husband disposed to offend everybody. It was after the dinner hour, and she found her father and mother seated together alone in the drawing-room. They greeted her with sad looks, saying, "Well, my dear," and no more. She had never seen her father look so downcast, and seating herself near him, she said,
"Is there anything the matter, Papa?"
He did not answer, but Mrs. Vincey said,
"Oh, my dear, have you heard nothing? It won't be long before it reaches you."
"Is it anything about Tertius?"
said Rosamond, turning pale. The idea of trouble immediately connected itself with what had been unaccountable to her in him.
"Oh, my dear, yes. To think of your marrying into this trouble. Debt was bad enough, but this will be worse."
"Stay, stay, Lucy," said Mr. Vincey. "Have you heard nothing about your Uncle Bulstrode, Rosamond?"
"No, Papa," said the poor thing,
feeling as if trouble were not anything she had before experienced, but some invisible power with an iron grasp that made her soul faint within her. Her father told her everything, saying at the end,
"It's better for you to know, my dear. I think Lydgate must leave the town. Things have gone against him. I dare say he couldn't help it. I don't accuse him of any harm," said Mr. Vincey.
He had always before been disposed to find the utmost fault with Lydgate. The shock to Rosamond was terrible. It seemed to her that no lot could be so cruelly hard as hers,
to have married a man who had become the centre of infamous suspicions. In many cases it is inevitable that the shame is felt to be the worst part of crime, and it would have required a great deal of disentangling reflection, such as had never entered into Rosamond's life, for her in these moments to feel that her trouble was less than if her husband had been certainly known to have done something criminal. All the shame seemed to be there, and she had innocently married this man with the belief that he and his family were a glory to her. She showed her usual reticence to her parents, and only said that if Lydgate had done as she wished, he would have left Middlemarch long ago. "She bears it beyond anything," said her mother when she was gone. "Ah, thank God," said Mr. Vincey, who was much broken down. But Rosamond went home with a sense of justified repugnance towards her husband. What had he really done? How had he really acted? She did not know. Why had he not told her everything? He did not speak to her on the subject, and of course she could not speak to him. It came into her mind once that she would ask her father to let her go home again, but dwelling on that prospect made it seem utter dreariness to her. A married woman gone back to live with her parents. Life seemed to have no meaning for her in such a position. She could not contemplate herself in it. The next 2 days, Lydgate observed a change in her, and believed that she had heard the bad news. Would she speak to him about it, or would she go on forever in the silence which seemed to imply that she believed him guilty? We must remember that he was in a morbid state of mind, in which almost all contact was pain. Certainly Rosamond in this case had equal reason to complain of reserve and want of confidence on his part. But in the bitterness of his soul he excused himself. Was he not justified in shrinking from the task of telling her, since now she knew the truth, she had no impulse to speak to him? But a deeper lying consciousness that he was in fault made him restless, and the silence between them became intolerable to him. It was as if they were both adrift on one piece of wreck, and looked away from each other. He thought, "I am a fool. Haven't I given up expecting anything? I have married care, not help." And that evening he said, "Rosamond, have you heard anything that distresses you?"
"Yes,"
she answered, laying down her work, which she had been carrying on with a languid semi-consciousness, most unlike her usual self. "What have you heard?"
"Everything, I suppose. Papa told me."
"That people think me disgraced?"
"Yes,"
said Rosamond faintly, beginning to sew again automatically. There was silence. Lydgate thought, if she has any trust in me, any notion of what I am, she ought to speak now and say that she does not believe I have deserved disgrace. But Rosamond on her side went on moving her fingers languidly. Whatever was to be said on the subject, she expected to come from Tertius. What did she know? And if he were innocent of any wrong, why did he not do something to clear himself? This silence of hers brought a new rush of gall to that bitter mood in which Lydgate had been saying to himself that nobody believed in him. Even Fairbrother had not come forward. He had begun to question her with the intent that their conversation should disperse the chill fog which had gathered between them. But he felt his resolution checked by despairing resentment. Even this trouble, like the rest, she seemed to regard as if it were hers alone. He was always to her a being apart, doing what she objected to. He started from his chair with an angry impulse, and thrusting his hands in his pockets, walked up and down the room. There was an underlying consciousness all the while that he should have to master this anger and tell her everything and convince her of the facts. For he had almost learned the lesson that he must bend himself to her nature, and that because she came short in her sympathy, he must give the more. Soon he recurred to his intention of opening himself. The occasion must not be lost. If he could bring her to feel with some solemnity that here was a slander which must be met and not run away from, and that the whole trouble had come out of his desperate want of money, it would be a moment for urging powerfully on her that they should be one in the resolve to do with as little money as possible,
so that they might weather the bad time and keep themselves independent. He would mention the definite measures which he desired to take and win her to a willing spirit. He was bound to try this. And what else was there for him to do? He did not know how long he had been walking uneasily backwards and forwards, but Rosamond felt that it was long and wished that he would sit down. She, too, had begun to think this an opportunity for urging on Tertius what he ought to do. Whatever might be the truth about all this misery, there was one dread which asserted itself. Lydgate at last seated himself, not in his usual chair, but in one nearer to Rosamond, leaning aside in it towards her, and looking at her gravely before he reopened the sad subject. He had conquered himself so far, and was about to speak with a sense of solemnity, as on an occasion which was not to be repeated. He had even opened his lips, when Rosamond, letting her hands fall, looked at him and said,
"Surely, Tertius."
"Well?"
"Surely now at last you have given up the idea of staying in Middlemarch. I cannot go on living here. Let us go to London. Papa and everyone else says you had better go. Whatever misery I have to put up with, it will be easier away from here."
Lydgate felt miserably jarred. Instead of that critical outpouring for which he had prepared himself with effort, here was the old round to be gone through again. He could not bear it. With a quick change of countenance he rose and went out of the room. Perhaps if he had been strong enough to persist in his determination to be the more because she was less, that evening might have had a better issue. If his energy could have borne down that check, he might still have wrought on Rosamond's vision and will. We cannot be sure that any natures, however inflexible or peculiar, will resist this effect from a more massive being than their own. They may be taken by storm, and for the moment converted, becoming part of the soul which enwraps them in the ardour of its movement. But poor Lydgate had a throbbing pain within him, and his energy had fallen short of its task. The beginning of mutual understanding and resolve seemed as far off as ever. Nay, it seemed blocked out by the sense of unsuccessful effort. They lived on from day to day with their thoughts still apart, Lydgate going about what work he had in a mood of despair, and Rosamond feeling with some justification that he was behaving cruelly. It was of no use to say anything to Tertius, but when Will Ladislaw came, she was determined to tell him everything. In spite of her general reticence, she needed someone who would recognize her wrongs.
Chapter 76. Some days later, Lydgate was riding to Lowick Manor in consequence of a summons from Dorothea. The summons had not been unexpected, since it had followed a letter from Mr. Bulstrode, in which he stated that he had resumed his arrangements for quitting Middlemarch, and must remind Lydgate of his previous communications about the hospital, to the purport of which he still adhered. It had been his duty, before taking further steps, to reopen the subject with Mrs. Casaubon, who now wished, as before, to discuss the question with Lydgate. "Your views may possibly have undergone some change," wrote Mr. Bulstrode, "but in that case also it is desirable that you should lay them before her." Dorothea awaited his arrival with eager interest. Though, in deference to her masculine advisers, she had refrained from what Sir James had called interfering in this Bulstrode business, the hardship of Lydgate's position was continually in her mind, and when Bulstrode applied to her again about the hospital, she felt that the opportunity was come to her which she had been hindered from hastening. In her luxurious home, wandering under the boughs of her own great trees, her thought was going out over the lot of others, and her emotions were imprisoned. The idea of some active good within her reach haunted her like a passion, and another's need, having once come to her as a distinct image, preoccupied her desire with the yearning to give relief, and made her own ease tasteless. She was full of confident hope about this interview with Lydgate, never heeding what was said of his personal reserve, never heeding that she was a very young woman. Nothing could have seemed more irrelevant to Dorothea than insistence on her youth and sex, when she was moved to show her human fellowship. As she sat waiting in the library, she could do nothing but live through again all the past scenes which had brought Lydgate into her memories. They all owed their significance to her marriage and its troubles. But no, there were two occasions in which the image of Lydgate had come painfully in connection with his wife and someone else. The pain had been allayed for Dorothea, but it had left in her an awakening conjecture as to what Lydgate's marriage might be to him, a susceptibility to the slightest hint about Mrs. Lydgate. These thoughts were like a drama to her, and made her eyes bright, and gave an attitude of suspense to her whole frame, though she was only looking out from the brown library onto the turf and the bright green buds which stood in relief against the dark evergreens. When Lydgate came in, she was almost shocked at the change in his face, which was strikingly perceptible to her who had not seen him for 2 months. It was not the change of emaciation, but that effect which even young faces will very soon show from the persistent presence of resentment and despondency. Her cordial look, when she put out her hand to him, softened his expression, but only with melancholy. "I have wished very much to see you for a long while, Mr. Lydgate," said Dorothea, when they were seated opposite each other. "But I put off asking you to come until Mr. Bulstrode applied to me again about the hospital. I know that the advantage of keeping the management of it separate from that of the infirmary depends on you, or at least on the good which you are encouraged to hope for from having it under your control, and I am sure you will not refuse to tell me exactly what you think."
"You want to decide whether you should give a generous support to the hospital," said Lydgate. "I cannot conscientiously advise you to do it in dependence on any activity of mine. I may be obliged to leave the town."
He spoke curtly, feeling the ache of despair as to his being able to carry out any purpose that Rosamond had set her mind against.
"Not because there is no one to believe in you," said Dorothea, pouring out her words in clearness from a full heart. "I know the unhappy mistakes about you. I knew them from the first moment to be mistakes. You have never done anything vile. You would not do anything dishonourable."
It was the first assurance of belief in him that had fallen on Lydgate's ears. He drew a deep breath and said, "Thank you." He could say no more. It was something very new and strange in his life, that these few words of trust from a woman should be so much to him.
"I beseech you to tell me how everything was," said Dorothea fearlessly. "I am sure that the truth would clear you."
Lydgate started up from his chair and went towards the window, forgetting where he was. He had so often gone over in his mind the possibility of explaining everything without aggravating appearances that would tell, perhaps unfairly, against Bulstrode, and had so often decided against it. He had so often said to himself that his assertions would not change people's impressions, that Dorothea's words sounded like a temptation to do something which in his soberness he had pronounced to be unreasonable.
"Tell me, pray," said Dorothea, with simple earnestness. "Then we can consult together. It is wicked to let people think evil of anyone falsely when it can be hindered."
Lydgate turned, remembering where he was, and saw Dorothea's face looking up at him with a sweet, trustful gravity. The presence of a noble nature, generous in its wishes, ardent in its charity, changes the lights for us. We begin to see things again in their larger, quieter masses, and to believe that we too can be seen and judged in the wholeness of our character. That influence was beginning to act on Lydgate, who had for many days been seeing all life as one who is dragged and struggling amid the throng. He sat down again, and felt that he was recovering his old self, in the consciousness that he was with one who believed in it. "I don't want," he said, "to bear hard on Bulstrode, who has lent me money of which I was in need, though I would rather have gone without it now. He is hunted down and miserable, and has only a poor thread of life in him. But I should like to tell you everything. It will be a comfort to me to speak where belief has gone beforehand, and where I shall not seem to be offering assertions of my own honesty. You will feel what is fair to another, as you feel what is fair to me."
"Do trust me," said Dorothea. "I will not repeat anything without your leave. But at the very least I could say that you have made all the circumstances clear to me, and that I know you are not in any way guilty. Mr. Fairbrother would believe me, and my uncle, and Sir James Chettam. Nay, there are persons in Middlemarch to whom I could go. Although they don't know much of me, they would believe me. They would know that I could have no other motive than truth and justice. I would take any pains to clear you. I have very little to do. There is nothing better that I can do in the world."
Dorothea's voice, as she made this childlike picture of what she would do, might have been almost taken as a proof that she could do it effectively. The searching tenderness of her woman's tones seemed made for a defence against ready accusers. Lydgate did not stay to think that she was quixotic. He gave himself up for the first time in his life to the exquisite sense of leaning entirely on a generous sympathy without any check of proud reserve. And he told her everything. From the time when, under the pressure of his difficulties, he unwillingly made his first application to Bulstrode. Gradually, in the relief of speaking, getting into a more thorough utterance of what had gone on in his mind, entering fully into the fact that his treatment of the patient was opposed to the dominant practice, into his doubts at the last, his ideal of medical duty, and his uneasy consciousness that the acceptance of the money had made some difference in his private inclination and professional behaviour, though not in his fulfilment of any publicly recognised obligation. "It has come to my knowledge since," he added, "that Hawley sent someone to examine the housekeeper at Stone Court, and she said that she gave the patient all the opium in the phial I left, as well as a good deal of brandy. But that would not have been opposed to ordinary prescriptions even of first-rate men. The suspicions against me had no hold there. They are grounded on the knowledge that I took money, that Bulstrode had strong motives for wishing the man to die, and that he gave me the money as a bribe to concur in some malpractices or other against the patient. That in any case I accepted a bribe to hold my tongue. They are just the suspicions that cling the most obstinately, because they lie in people's inclination and can never be disproved. How my orders came to be disobeyed is a question to which I don't know the answer. It is still possible that Bulstrode was innocent of any criminal intention, even possible that he had nothing to do with the disobedience and merely abstained from mentioning it. But all that has nothing to do with the public belief. It is one of those cases on which a man is condemned on the ground of his character. It is believed that he has committed a crime in some undefined way because he had the motive for doing it. And Bulstrode's character has enveloped me because I took his money. I am simply blighted, like a damaged ear of corn. The business is done and can't be undone."
"Oh, it is hard," said Dorothea. "I understand the difficulty there is in your vindicating yourself, and that all this should have come to you, who had meant to lead a higher life than the common and to find out better ways. I cannot bear to rest in this as unchangeable. I know you meant that. I remember what you said to me when you first spoke to me about the hospital. There is no sorrow I have thought more about than that, to love what is great and try to reach it, and yet to fail."
"Yes," said Lydgate, feeling that here he had found room for the full meaning of his grief. "I had some ambition. I meant everything to be different with me. I thought I had more strength and mastery. But the most terrible obstacles are such as nobody can see except oneself."
"Suppose," said Dorothea meditatively, "suppose we kept on the hospital according to the present plan, and you stayed here, though only with the friendship and support of a few. The evil feeling towards you would gradually die out. There would come opportunities in which people would be forced to acknowledge that they had been unjust to you, because they would see that your purposes were pure. You may still win a great fame like the Louis and Lennec I have heard you speak of, and we shall all be proud of you," she ended with a smile.
"That might do if I had my old trust in myself," said Lydgate mournfully. "Nothing galls me more than the notion of turning round and running away before this slander, leaving it unchecked behind me. Still, I can't ask anyone to put a great deal of money into a plan which depends on me.
It would be quite worth my while, said Dorothea simply. Only think, I am very uncomfortable with my money, because they tell me I have too little for any great scheme of the sort I like best, and yet I have too much. I don't know what to do. I have 700 a year of my own fortune, and 1900 a year that Mr. Casaubon left me, and between 3,000 and 4,000 of ready money in the bank. I wish to raise money and pay it off gradually out of my income, which I don't want, to buy land with, and found a village which should be a school of industry. But Sir James and my uncle have convinced me that the risk would be too great. So you see that what I should most rejoice at would be to have something good to do with my money. I should like it to make other people's lives better to them. It makes me very uneasy, coming all to me who don't want it. A smile broke through the gloom of Lydgate's face. The childlike, grave-eyed earnestness with which Dorothea said all this was irresistible, blent into an adorable whole with her ready understanding of high experience. Of lower experience, such as plays a great part in the world, poor Mrs. Casaubon had a very blurred, short-sighted knowledge, little helped by her imagination. But she took the smile as encouragement of her plan. "I think you see now that you spoke too scrupulously," she said, in a tone of persuasion. "The hospital would be one good, and making your life quite whole and well again would be another." Lydgate's smile had died away. "You have the goodness as well as the money to do all that, if it could be done," he said. "But—" He hesitated a little while, looking vaguely towards the window, and she sat in silent expectation. At last he turned towards her and said impetuously, "Why should I not tell you? You know what sort of bond marriage is. You will understand everything." Dorothea felt her heart beginning to beat faster. Had he that sorrow too? But she feared to say any word, and he went on immediately, "It is impossible for me now to do anything, to take any step, without considering my wife's happiness. The thing that I might like to do if I were alone is become impossible to me. I can't see her miserable. She married me without knowing what she was going into, and it might have been better for her if she had not married me."
"I know, I know. You could not give her pain if you were not obliged to do it," said Dorothea, with keen memory of her own life.
"And she has set her mind against staying. She wishes to go. The troubles she has had here have wearied her," said Lydgate, breaking off again, lest he should say too much.
"But when she saw the good that might come of staying," said Dorothea, remonstrantly, looking at Lydgate as if he had forgotten the reasons which had just been considered.
He did not speak immediately.
"She would not see it," he said at last, curtly, feeling at first that this statement must do without explanation. "And indeed I have lost all spirit about carrying on my life here."
He paused a moment, and then, following the impulse to let Dorothea see deeper into the difficulty of his life, he said, "The fact is, this trouble has come upon her confusedly. We have not been able to speak to each other about it. I am not sure what is in her mind about it. She may fear that I have really done something base. It is my fault. I ought to be more open. But I have been suffering cruelly."
"May I go and see her?" said Dorothea eagerly. "Would she accept my sympathy? I would tell her that you have not been blamable before anyone's judgment but your own. I would tell her that you shall be cleared in every fair mind. I would cheer her heart. Will you ask her if I may go to see her? I did see her once."
"I am sure you may," said Lydgate, seizing the proposition with some hope. "She would feel honoured, cheered, I think, by the proof that you at least have some respect for me." "I will not speak to her about your coming, that she may not connect it with my wishes at all. I know very well that I ought not to have left anything to be told her by others, but—"
He broke off, and there was a moment's silence. Dorothea refrained from saying what was in her mind, how well she knew that there might be invisible barriers to speech between husband and wife,
This was a point on which even sympathy might make a wound. She returned to the more outward aspect of Lydgate's position, saying cheerfully, "And if Mrs. Lydgate knew that there were friends who would believe in you and support you, she might then be glad that you should stay in your place and recover your hopes and do what you meant to do. Perhaps then you would see that it was right to agree with what I proposed about your continuing at the hospital. Surely you would if you still have faith in it as a means of making your knowledge useful." Lydgate did not answer, and she saw that he was debating with himself. "You need not decide immediately," she said gently. "A few days hence, it will be early enough for me to send my answer to Mr. Bulstrode." Lydgate still waited, but at last turned to speak in his most decisive tones. "No, I prefer that there should be no interval left for wavering. I am no longer sure enough of myself. I mean of what it would be possible for me to do under the changed circumstances of my life. It would be dishonourable to let others engage themselves to anything serious in dependence on me. I might be obliged to go away after all. I see little chance of anything else. The whole thing is too problematic. I cannot consent to be the cause of your goodness being wasted. No, let the new hospital be joined with the old infirmary and everything go on as it might have done if I had never come. I have kept a valuable register since I have been there. I shall send it to a man who will make use of it," he ended bitterly. "I can think of nothing for a long while but getting an income."
"It hurts me very much to hear you speak so hopelessly," said Dorothea. "It would be a happiness to your friends who believe in your future, in your power to do great things, if you would let them save you from that. Think how much money I have. It would be like taking a burden from me if you took some of it every year till you got free from this fettering want of income. Why should not people do these things? It is so difficult to make shares at all even. This is one way."
"God bless you, Mrs. Casaubon," said Lydgate, rising as if with the same impulse that made his words energetic, and resting his arm on the back of the great leather chair he had been sitting in. "It is good that you should have such feelings, but I am not the man who ought to allow himself to benefit by them. I have not given guarantees enough. I must not at least sink into the degradation of being pensioned for work that I never achieved. It is very clear to me that I must not count on anything else than getting away from Middlemarch as soon as I can manage it. I should not be able for a long while, at the very best, to get an income here. And it is easier to make the necessary changes in a new place. I must do as other men do, and think what will please the world and bring in money. Look for a little opening in the London crowd and push myself. Set up in a watering place or go to some southern town where there are plenty of idle English and get myself puffed. That is a sort of shell I must creep into and try to keep my soul alive in."
"Now that is not brave," said Dorothea, "to give up the fight."
"No, it is not brave," said Lydgate. "But if a man is afraid of creeping paralysis..."
Then in another tone,
"Yet you have made a great difference in my courage by believing in me. Everything seems more bearable since I have talked to you. And if you can clear me in a few other minds, especially in Fairbrothers, I shall be deeply grateful. The point I wish you not to mention is the fact of disobedience to my orders. That would soon get distorted. After all, there is no evidence for me but people's opinion of me beforehand. You can only repeat my own report of myself."
"Mr. Fairbrother will believe, others will believe," said Dorothea. "I can say of you what will make it stupidity to suppose that you would be bribed to do a wickedness."
"I don't know," said Lydgate, with something like a groan in his voice. "I have not taken a bribe yet, but there is a pale shade of bribery which is sometimes called prosperity." "You will do me another great kindness, then, and come to see my wife."
"Yes, I will. I remember how pretty she is," said Dorothea, into whose mind every impression about Rosamond had cut deep.
I hope she will like me.
As Lydgate rode away, he thought, "This young creature has a heart large enough for the Virgin Mary. She evidently thinks nothing of her own future, and would pledge away half her income at once, as if she wanted nothing for herself but a chair to sit in, from which she can look down with those clear eyes at the poor mortals who pray to her. She seems to have what I never saw in any woman before, a fountain of friendship towards men. A man can make a friend of her. Casaubon must have raised some heroic hallucination in her. I wonder if she could have any other sort of passion for a man. Ladislaw? There was certainly an unusual feeling between them, and Casaubon must have had a notion of it. Well, her love might help a man more than her money." Dorothea, on her side, had immediately formed a plan of relieving Lydgate from his obligation to Bulstrode, which she felt sure was a part, though small, of the galling pressure he had to bear. She sat down at once under the inspiration of their interview, and wrote a brief note, in which she pleaded that she had more claim than Mr. Bulstrode had to the satisfaction of providing the money which had been serviceable to Lydgate, that it would be unkind in Lydgate not to grant her the position of being his helper in this small matter, the favour being entirely to her, who had so little that was plainly marked out for her to do with her superfluous money. He might call her a creditor, or by any other name, if it did but imply that he granted her request. She enclosed a cheque for £1,000, and determined to take the letter with her the next day, when she went to see Rosamond.
Chapter 77. The next day Lydgate had to go to Brassing, and told Rosamond that he should be away until the evening. Of late she had never gone beyond her own house and garden except to church, and once to see her papa, to whom she said, "If Tertius goes away, you will help us to move, will you not, papa? I suppose we shall have very little money. I am sure I hope someone will help us." And Mr. Vincey had said, "Yes, child, I don't mind 100 or 2, I can see the end of that." With these exceptions, she had sat at home in languid melancholy and suspense, fixing her mind on Will Ladislaw's coming as the one point of hope and interest, and associating this with some new urgency on Lydgate to make immediate arrangements for leaving Middlemarch and going to London, till she felt assured that the coming would be a potent cause of the going, without at all seeing how. This way of establishing sequences is too common to be fairly regarded as a peculiar folly in Rosamond, and it is precisely this sort of sequence which causes the greatest shock when it is sundered. For to see how an effect may be produced is often to see possible missings and checks, but to see nothing except the desirable cause and close upon it the desirable effect rids us of doubt and makes our minds strongly intuitive. That was the process going on in poor Rosamond, while she arranged all objects around her with the same nicety as ever, only with more slowness, or sat down to the piano meaning to play, and then desisting, yet lingering on the music-stool with her white fingers suspended on the wooden front, and looking before her in dreamy ennui. Her melancholy had become so marked that Lydgate felt a strange timidity before it, as a perpetual silent reproach, and the strong man, mastered by his keen sensibilities towards this fair, fragile creature whose life he seemed somehow to have bruised, shrank from her look, and sometimes started at her approach. Fear of her, and fear for her, rushing in only the more forcibly after it had been momentarily expelled by exasperation. But this morning Rosamond descended from her room upstairs, where she sometimes sat the whole day when Lydgate was out, equipped for a walk in the town. She had a letter to post, a letter addressed to Mr. Ladislaw, and written with charming discretion, but intended to hasten his arrival by a hint of trouble. The servant-maid, their sole house-servant now, noticed her coming downstairs in her walking-dress and thought, "There never did anybody look so pretty in a bonnet, poor thing." Meanwhile, Dorothea's mind was filled with her project of going to Rosamond, and with the many thoughts, both of the past and the probable future, which gathered round the idea of that visit. Until yesterday, when Lydgate had opened to her a glimpse of some trouble in his married life, The image of Mrs. Lydgate had always been associated for her with that of Will Ladislaw. Even in her most uneasy moments, even when she had been agitated by Mrs. Cadwallader's painfully graphic report of gossip, her effort, nay, her strongest impulsive prompting, had been towards the vindication of Will from any sullying surmises. And when in her meeting with him afterwards, she had at first interpreted his words as a probable allusion to a feeling towards Mrs. Lydgate, which he was determined to cut himself off from indulging, she had had a quick, sad, excusing vision of the charm there might be in his constant opportunities of companionship with that fair creature, who most likely shared his other tastes, as she evidently did his delight in music. But there had followed his parting words, the few passionate words in which he had implied that she herself was the object of whom his love held him in dread, that it was his love for her only which he was resolved not to declare but to carry away into banishment. From the time of that parting, Dorothea, believing in Will's love for her, believing with a proud delight in his delicate sense of honour and his determination that no one should impeach him justly, felt her heart quite at rest as to the regard he might have for Mrs. Lydgate. She was sure that the regard was blameless. There are natures in which, if they love us, we are conscious of having a sort of baptism and consecration. They bind us over to rectitude and purity by their pure belief about us, and our sins become that worst kind of sacrilege which tears down the invisible altar of trust. If you are not good, none is good. Those little words may give a terrific meaning to responsibility, may hold a vitriolic intensity for remorse. Dorothea's nature was of that kind. Her own passionate faults lay along the easily counted open channels of her ardent character, and while she was full of pity for the visible mistakes of others, she had not yet any material within her experience for subtle constructions and suspicions of hidden wrong. But that simplicity of hers, holding up an ideal for others in her believing conception of them, was one of the great powers of her womanhood, and it had from the first acted strongly on Will Ladislaw. He felt when he parted from her that the brief words by which he had tried to convey to her his feelings about herself and the division which her fortune made between them would only profit by their brevity when Dorothea had to interpret them. He felt that in her mind he had found his highest estimate. And he was right there. In the months since their parting, Dorothea had felt a delicious, sad repose in their relation to each other, as one which was inwardly whole and without blemish. She had an active force of antagonism within her, when the antagonism turned on the defence either of plans or persons that she believed in, and the wrongs which she felt that Will had received from her husband, and the external conditions which to others were grounds for slighting him, only gave the more tenacity to her affection and admiring judgment. And now, with the disclosures about Bulstrode, had come another fact affecting Will's social position, which roused afresh Dorothea's inward resistance to what was said about him, in that part of her world which lay within park palings. "Young Ladislaw, the grandson of a thieving Jew pawnbroker," was a phrase which had entered emphatically into the dialogues about the Bulstrode business at Lowick, Tipton and Freshett, and was a worse kind of placard on poor Will's back than the Italian with white mice. Upright Sir James Chettam was convinced that his own satisfaction was righteous, when he thought, with some complacency, that here was an added league to that mountainous distance between Ladislaw and Dorothea, which enabled him to dismiss any anxiety in that direction as too absurd. And perhaps there had been some pleasure in pointing Mr. Brooke's attention to this ugly bit of Ladislaw's genealogy, as a fresh candle for him to see his own folly by. Dorothea had observed the animus with which Will's part in the painful story had been recalled more than once, but she had uttered no word, being checked now, as she had not been formally in speaking of Will, by the consciousness of a deeper relation between them, which must always remain in consecrated secrecy. But her silence shrouded her resistant emotion into a more thorough glow, and this misfortune in Will's lot, which it seemed others were wishing to fling at his back as an opprobrium, only gave something more of enthusiasm to her clinging thought. She entertained no visions of their ever coming into nearer union, and yet she had taken no posture of renunciation. She had accepted her whole relation to Will very simply as part of her marriage sorrows, and would have thought it very sinful in her to keep up an inward wail because she was not completely happy, being rather disposed to dwell on the superfluities of her lot. She could bear that the chief pleasures of her tenderness should lie in memory, and the idea of marriage came to her solely as a repulsive proposition from some suitor of whom she at present knew nothing, but whose merits, as seen by her friends, would be a source of torment to her. "Somebody who will manage your property for you, my dear," was Mr. Brooke's attractive suggestion of suitable characteristics. "I should like to manage it myself, if I knew what to do with it," said Dorothea. No. She adhered to her declaration that she would never be married again, and in the long valley of her life, which looked so flat and empty of waymarks, guidance would come as she walked along the road and saw her fellow passengers by the way. This habitual state of feeling about Will Ladislaw had been strong in all her waking hours since she had proposed to pay a visit to Mrs. Lydgate, making a sort of background against which she saw Rosamond's figure presented to her without hindrances to her interest and compassion. There was evidently some mental separation, some barrier to complete confidence which had arisen between this wife and the husband who had yet made her happiness a law to him. That was a trouble which no third person must directly touch. But Dorothea thought with deep pity of the loneliness which must have come upon Rosamond from the suspicions cast on her husband. And there would surely be help in the manifestation of respect for Lydgate and sympathy with her. "I shall talk to her about her husband," thought Dorothea as she was being driven towards the town. The clear spring morning, the scent of the moist earth, the fresh leaves just showing their creased-up wealth of greenery from out their half-open sheaths, seemed part of the cheerfulness she was feeling from a long conversation with Mr. Fairbrother, who had joyfully accepted the justifying explanation of Lydgate's conduct. "I shall take Mrs. Lydgate good news, and perhaps she will like to talk to me and make a friend of me." Dorothea had another errand in Lowick Gate. It was about a new, fine-toned bell for the schoolhouse, and as she had to get out of her carriage very near to Lydgate's, she walked thither across the street, having told the coachman to wait for some packages. The street door was open, and the servant was taking the opportunity of looking out at the carriage which was pausing within sight, when it became apparent to her that the lady who belonged to it was coming towards her. "Is Mrs. Lydgate at home?" said Dorothea.
"I'm not sure, my lady. I'll see if you'll please walk in," said Martha, a little confused on the score of her kitchen apron, but collected enough to be sure that Mum was not the right title for this queenly young widow with a carriage and pair.
"Will you please to walk in, and I'll go and see?"
"Say that I am Mrs. Casaubon," said Dorothea, as Martha moved forward, intending to show her into the drawing-room, and then to go upstairs to see if Rosamond had returned from her walk. They crossed the broader part of the entrance hall, and turned up the passage which led to the garden. The drawing-room door was unlatched, and Martha, pushing it without looking into the room, waited for Mrs. Casaubon to enter, and then turned away, the door having swung open and swung back again without noise. Dorothea had less of outward vision than usual this morning, being filled with images of things as they had been and were going to be. She found herself on the other side of the door without seeing anything remarkable. But immediately she heard a voice speaking in low tones, which startled her as with a sense of dreaming in daylight, and advancing unconsciously a step or two beyond the projecting slab of a bookcase, she saw, in the terrible illumination of a certainty which filled up all outlines, something which made her pause motionless, without self-possession enough to speak. Seated with his back towards her, on a sofa, which stood against the wall on a line with the door by which she had entered, she saw Will Ladislaw. Close by him, and turned towards him with a flushed tearfulness which gave a new brilliancy to her face, sat Rosamond, her bonnet hanging back, while Will, leaning towards her, clasped both her upraised hands in his, and spoke with low-toned fervour. Rosamond, in her agitated absorption, had not noticed the silently advancing figure. But when Dorothea, after the first immeasurable instant of this vision, moved confusedly backward and found herself impeded by some piece of furniture, Rosamond was suddenly aware of her presence, and with a spasmodic movement snatched away her hands and rose, looking at Dorothea, who was necessarily arrested. Will Ladislaw, starting up, looked round also, and meeting Dorothea's eyes with a new lightning in them, seemed changing to marble. But she immediately turned them away from him to Rosamond, and said in a firm voice,
"Excuse me, Mrs. Lydgate. The servant did not know that you were here. I called to deliver an important letter for Mr. Lydgate, which I wish to put into your own hands."
She laid down the letter on the small table which had checked her retreat, and then, including Rosamond and Will in one distant glance and bow, she went quickly out of the room, meeting in the passage the surprised Martha, who said she was sorry the mistress was not at home, and then showed the strange lady out, with an inward reflection that grand people were probably more impatient than others. Dorothea walked across the street with her most elastic step and was quickly in her carriage again. "Drive on to Freshett Hall," she said to the coachman, and anyone looking at her might have thought that though she was paler than usual, she was never animated by a more self-possessed energy. And that was really her experience. It was as if she had drunk a great draught of scorn that stimulated her beyond the susceptibility to other feelings. She had seen something so far below her belief that her emotions rushed back from it and made an excited throng without an object. She needed something active to turn her excitement out upon. She felt power to walk and work for a day without meat or drink, and she would carry out the purpose with which she had started in the morning, of going to Freshett and Tipton to tell Sir James and her uncle all that she wished them to know about Lydgate, whose married loneliness under his trial now presented itself to her with new significance, and made her more ardent in readiness to be his champion. She had never felt anything like this triumphant power of indignation in the struggle of her married life, in which there had always been a quickly subduing pang, and she took it as a sign of new strength.
"Dodo, how very bright your eyes are," said Celia, when Sir James was gone out of the room. "And you don't see anything you look at, Arthur or anything. You are going to do something uncomfortable, I know. Is it all about Mr. Lydgate, or has something else happened?"
Celia had been used to watch her sister with expectation.
"Yes, dear, a great many things have happened," said Dodo in her full tones. "I wonder what," said Celia, folding her arms cosily and leaning forward upon them.
"Oh, all the troubles of all people on the face of the earth," said Dorothea, lifting her arms to the back of her head.
"Dear me, Dodo, are you going to have a scheme for them?" said Celia, a little uneasy at this Hamlet-like raving.
But Sir James came in again, ready to accompany Dorothea to the Grange, and she finished her expedition well, not swerving in her resolution until she descended at her own door.
Chapter 78. Rosamond and Will stood motionless. They did not know how long. He looking towards the spot where Dorothea had stood, and she looking towards him with doubt. It seemed an endless time to Rosamond, in whose inmost soul there was hardly so much annoyance as gratification from what had just happened. Shallow natures dream of an easy sway over the emotions of others, trusting implicitly in their own petty magic to turn the deepest streams, and confident by pretty gestures and remarks of making the thing that is not as though it were. She knew that Will had received a severe blow, but she had been little used to imagining other people's states of mind except as a material cut into shape by her own wishes, and she believed in her own power to soothe or subdue. Even Tertius, that most perverse of men, was always subdued in the long run. Events had been obstinate, but still Rosamond would have said now, as she did before her marriage, that she never gave up what she had set her mind on. She put out her arm and laid the tips of her fingers on Will's coat sleeve.
"Don't touch me!" he said, with an utterance like the cut of a lash, darting from her and changing from pink to white and back again
as if his whole frame were tingling with the pain of the sting. He wheeled round to the other side of the room and stood opposite to her, with the tips of his fingers in his pockets and his head thrown back, looking fiercely not at Rosamond, but at a point a few inches away from her. She was keenly offended, but the signs she made of this were such as only Lydgate was used to interpret. She became suddenly quiet and seated herself, untying her hanging bonnet and laying it down with her shawl. Her little hands, which she folded before her, were very cold. It would have been safer for Will in the first instance to have taken up his hat and gone away. But he had felt no impulse to do this. On the contrary, he had a horrible inclination to stay and shatter Rosamond with his anger. It seemed as impossible to bear the fatality she had drawn down on him without venting his fury, as it would be to a panther to bear the javelin wound without springing and biting. And yet, how could he tell a woman that he was ready to curse her? He was fuming under a repressive law which he was forced to acknowledge. He was dangerously poised, and Rosamond's voice now brought the decisive vibration. In flute-like tones of sarcasm, she said,
"You can easily go after Mrs. Casaubon and explain your preference."
"Go after her," he burst out with a sharp edge in his voice. "Do you think she would turn to look at me, or value any word I ever uttered to her again at more than a dirty feather? Explain! How can a man explain at the expense of a woman?"
"You can tell her what you please," said Rosamond, with more tremor.
"Do you suppose she would like me better for sacrificing you? She is not a woman to be flattered because I made myself despicable, to believe that I must be true to her because I was a dastard to you."
He began to move about with the restlessness of a wild animal that sees prey but cannot reach it. Presently he burst out again.
"I had no hope before, not much, of anything better to come. But I had one certainty, that she believed in me. Whatever people had said or done about me, she believed in me. That's gone. She'll never again think me anything but a paltry pretense. Too nice to take heaven except upon flattering conditions, and yet selling myself for any devil's change by the sly. She'll think of me as an incarnate insult to her from the first moment we—"
Will stopped, as if he had found himself grasping something that must not be thrown and shattered. He found another vent for his rage by snatching up Rosamond's words again as if they were reptiles to be throttled and flung off.
"Explain! Tell a man to explain how he dropped into hell! Explain my preference! I never had a preference for her any more than I have a preference for breathing! No other woman exists by the side of her. I would rather touch her hand if it were dead than I would touch any other woman's living."
Rosamond, while these poisoned weapons were being hurled at her, was almost losing the sense of her identity, and seemed to be waking into some new terrible existence. She had no sense of chill, resolute repulsion, of reticent self-justification such as she had known under Lydgate's most stormy displeasure. All her sensibility was turned into a bewildering novelty of pain. She felt a new, terrified recoil under a lash, never experienced before. What another nature felt in opposition to her own was being burned and bitten into her consciousness. When Will had ceased to speak, she had become an image of sickened misery. Her lips were pale, and her eyes had a tearless dismay in them. If it had been Tertius who stood opposite to her, that look of misery would have been a pang to him, and he would have sunk by her side to comfort her with that strong-armed comfort which she had often held very cheap. Let it be forgiven to Will that he had no such movement of pity. He had felt no bond beforehand to this woman who had spoiled the ideal treasure of his life, and he held himself blameless. He knew that he was cruel, but he had no relenting in him yet. After he had done speaking, he still moved about, half in absence of mind, and Rosamond sat perfectly still. At length, Will, seeming to bethink himself, took up his hat, yet stood some moments irresolute. He had spoken to her in a way that made a phrase of common politeness difficult to utter, and yet, now that he had come to the point of going away from her without further speech, he shrank from it as a brutality. He felt checked and stultified in his anger. He walked towards the mantelpiece and leaned his arm on it and waited in silence for he hardly knew what. The vindictive fire was still burning in him, and he could utter no word of retraction. But it was nevertheless in his mind that having come back to this hearth where he had enjoyed a caressing friendship, he had found calamity seated there. He had had suddenly revealed to him a trouble that lay outside the home as well as within it, and what seemed a foreboding was pressing upon him as with slow pincers. That his life might come to be enslaved by this helpless woman who had thrown herself upon him in the dreary sadness of her heart. But he was in gloomy rebellion against the fact that his quick apprehensiveness foreshadowed to him, and when his eyes fell on Rosamond's blighted face, it seemed to him that he was the more pitiable of the two, for pain must enter into its glorified life of memory before it can turn into compassion. And so they remained for many minutes, opposite each other, far apart, in silence. Will's face still possessed by a mute rage, and Rosamond's by a mute misery. The poor thing had no force to fling out any passion in return. The terrible collapse of the illusion towards which all her hope had been strained was a stroke which had too thoroughly shaken her. Her little world was in ruins, and she felt herself tottering in the midst as a lonely, bewildered consciousness. Will wished that she would speak and bring some mitigating shadow across his own cruel speech, which seemed to stand staring at them both in mockery of any attempt at revived fellowship. But she said nothing, and at last, with a desperate effort over himself, he asked, "Shall I come in and see Lydgate this evening?"
"If you like,"
Rosamond answered, just audibly. And then Will went out of the house, Martha never knowing that he had been in. After he was gone, Rosamond tried to get up from her seat, but fell back, fainting. When she came to herself again, she felt too ill to make the exertion of rising to ring the bell, and she remained helpless until the girl, surprised at her long absence, thought for the first time of looking for her in all the downstairs rooms. Rosamond said that she had felt suddenly sick and faint, and wanted to be helped upstairs. When there, she threw herself on the bed with her clothes on, and lay in apparent torpor, as she had done once before on a memorable day of grief. Lydgate came home earlier than he had expected, about 5:30, and found her there. The perception that she was ill threw every other thought into the background. When he felt her pulse, her eyes rested on him with more persistence than they had done for a long while, as if she felt some content that he was there. He perceived the difference in a moment, and seating himself by her, put his arm gently under her, and bending over her said, "My poor Rosamond, has something agitated you?" Clinging to him, she fell into hysterical sobbings and cries, and for the next hour he did nothing but soothe and tend her. He imagined that Dorothea had been to see her, and that all this effect on her nervous system, which evidently involved some new turning towards himself, was due to the excitement of the new impressions which that visit had raised.
End of disc 24.